You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we invite poets to select a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss. Then, we ask them to read a poem of their own that's appeared in the magazine. My guest today is the poet and translator, Ariel Francisco, who published his debut collection, All My Heroes Are Broke, in 2017. Welcome, Ariel. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man. I'm really excited.
So I'm excited, too. The poem you've chosen to read today is James Wright's poem, By a Lake in Minnesota. What drew you to this particular poem while you were looking through our archive?
Looking through the archive was just a ton of fun. So just typing in, you know, all the poets I admire and looking through all the poems that they've published in The New Yorker. And I had forgotten about this James Wright poem, though it is in, I think it's in The Branch Will Not Break, which
right.
is one of my favorite books. But it has so many good poems that even the good ones get buried amongst the other good ones. So it was like finding something familiar that I had forgotten that I really liked. So it was a joy to encounter it again in the archives.
Great. Let's hear it. This is Ariel Francisco reading By a Lake in Minnesota by James Wright.
By a lake in Minnesota. Upshore from the cloud, the slow wail of country twilight, the spume of light falls into valleys full of roses. And below, out of the placid waters, two beavers, mother and child, wave out long ripples to the dust of dead leaves on the shore. And the moon walks, hunting for hidden dolphins behind the darkening combers of the ground. And downshore from the cloud, I stand, waiting for dark.
I love that. That was By a Lake in Minnesota, written by James Wright, which was originally published in the September 17th, 1960 issue of the magazine. I love how it starts upshore and ends with this downshore.
Yeah, that opening line is just bananas. Upshore from the cloud, M-dash, that's a great way to open a poem.
I do love an M-dash,
yeah.
I'll be honest.
Back-to-back M-dashes.
Yeah, you gotta do it sometimes, Emily Dickinson. So tell me what else drew you to this? I mean, it's interesting in contrast to the poem we're going to see by you, because I feel like they're talking to each other in a funny way. In part, this is a study of nature, or is it nature as seen from the city, you know, that pastoral tradition? How do you think of it?
It's almost an existential crisis for me, this kind of observation of, you know, these gigantic things, the sky, and then, you know, twilight as a whale, and then sort of coming back down small to the beaver, and then back out again to the moon walking. You know, it's like this breathing, this kind of huge, small, huge, and then the smallest of all is, you know, the speaker standing in the dark at the end, just kind of under the weight of everything. It's kind of terrifying, but fantastic.
Well, and he's waiting, as in waiting for a train or something, but he's also feeling that weight. I love how you highlight that.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the slow wail of country twilight.
I mean, that's one of a great line. I want to steal it instantly. I mean, it feels very American, if that makes sense. It feels like something someone might say, but at the same time, it's so lyrical and rooted in this kind of surrealism that Wright is invested in, especially around this time and
right.
moving from his book, St. Judas, a book I loved, because it's a transition book, you know, and then The Branch Will Not Break, which is just a few years later, as you mentioned, and this poem is of that time, you know, those incredible poems of nature and, you know, I have wasted my life.
Right.
You know,
the
kind of grand pronouncements that it always returns to the eye for Wright.
Yeah. And this one in particular, I do, you know, that change he made from kind of those formal poems and then sort of throwing everything out and building this new kind of style. And the eye coming so late, right? It's just I stand is I think the only eye in this poem right there before the dark is, it's just great to, you know, to have him come into the poem finally, just at the very end as, like, the smallest part of it.
Well, and I wonder, do you think of him as a poet of place, a poet of existential crisis? Are they the same for him?
I think they might be. I think he's definitely a poet of place. Not just that, but, you know, that, especially that lying in a hammock. I love teaching that poem to my students because that's just, it gets no more specific than that. That title, you know, tells
yes.
you so much. Even if you've never been there, you can't really know it, but you can imagine it. So in a literal sense, you know, he's always conjuring places that we know he's familiar with that we might not be, but we can be through the poem. And there's definitely always, for me, in his work, some kind of existential dread happening. And it helps feel it when you can imagine the place that he's in, even if it's just like standing by a lake, right?
Yeah, I love that. I also feel like he's a poet invested, and even the title St. Judas plays with this kind of Christian iconography. And there's a kind of descent, ascent that is happening in these poems, you know, darkness and
right.
these very Manichaean, you know, like large, dark and light, up and down, you know, like me and no one.
Right.
Or the God that is sort of conjured but not, and these beavers interest me. You know, he knows their mother and child.
Right. Yeah. There's no question there.
They're kind of this holy family almost.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe what's absent, you know, if the poem's kind of being written in that time for him to, you know, project that onto them is kind of a tiny detail that might get lost, but, you know, probably hugely important to what he was going through in those times.
I'm struck, too, by the shortness of the lines, which I was not quite this years old, but, you know, fairly recently, I remember listening to him read A Blessing, his famous poem of, stopping and seeing these two horses which come up to him.
Yeah.
And he reads it incredibly slow, like every word, line, you know, like, wow, it's so emphasized.
Yeah.
And I think that's partially that break he's having between these kind of more formal poems and even the subject matter of those, which were wonderful, but then really opening up the work and changing it. These shorter lines, I think, really strike me, too.
Yeah, they're tricky. I fear the long line in my own writing.
So fear it.
It's difficult to go. The closer you get to the margin, the
I know there's
more
like a cat there that like swipes your hand.
Like the cliff's edge, you know?
Yeah.
So I stay away from the margin of the page. I like the short lines, but his short lines are incredible. Even, you know, just looking at the shortest ones, full of roses on the shore of the ground, I stand, pause, waiting for dark. Like just how much they contain is really difficult to try and accomplish, I think.
Well, it makes, you know, this is perhaps obvious, but it makes every word count.
Yeah.
I mean, he has that other poem about Autumn Comes to Martin's Ferry, Ohio. And, you know, there's that amazing moment where it's like, therefore.
Right.
There's a line that says, therefore. It's in a poem. You know, and I remember reading that and, you know, there's all sorts of questions of race in the poem. It's really wrestling with class and race in an interesting way. I think when I was much younger, I think I thought it was only troubling, but I think he's troubled.
Right.
And he's trying to write about it. I was like, therefore, that troubled me more than anything. You know, like I had rules in my mind of what you could do, and therefore as a line.
Right.
Or even, you know, of the ground as it is here.
Yeah.
And below. You know, but below is not just, as we were saying, you know, a place. It's
right.
a state.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think understanding that therefore is a state and below is a state and that he is trying to conjure them with the least words possible, I think is really a fruitful thing for us to think about.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's like a proclamation, you know, the importance of what follows or what comes before, but just to have that small unit of language standing by itself is something.
Are you comfortable with proclamations in poems?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with most things in poems. They're hard to do. I mean, he's, you know, I've Wasted My Life is probably one of the best ones. But it's difficult to pull off the kind of, I don't know if it's a confidence or if it's an understanding of where it goes in the poem and what that does to a reader. To have it at the end is one thing, right? To have it in the middle and then might have the promise of like an answer but not give the answer, you know? It can be tricky. I don't know how many proclamations I've made in my own poems.
But. Well, we're going to see in a minute, aren't we?
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I was interested in, and I was aware of this, I was thinking about it when I was rereading, is how influenced by surrealism, but specifically Latin American surrealism and poets like Vallejo, who are, I think, really doing interesting things. Do you think of that at all, or how does this poem speak to that for you?
Yeah, that's something that really interests me about James Wright, especially in that time, because that's when he was hanging out with Robert Bly, and they were translating Vallejo and I think Lorca and Neruda, and also kind of all those guys in the 60s. And I had read those Vallejo, Lorca, Neruda before I had encountered James Wright and Robert Bly. from my dad, because he has, you know, all these books and he's very familiar with those guys. So it's really interesting to see that relationship and to not know at the time that I read either that one had influenced the other, and then to kind of come to that knowledge after and be like, oh, wow, and then go back and sort of, you know, put the two side by side or look at what he was translating during that time. It's really, really interesting. And his translations of Hermann Hesse, too, I think, are really fantastic as well.
Well, I mean, Lorca's all over this poem.
Yeah.
I mean, Lorca is able, I think, to do that, you know, those little ballads and these little songs that he's able to kind of conjure, not just nature, and he grew up in the country, but in the country, and yet he's able to conjure so much spiritual agony or national questions through this nature. And you can see that influence, I think, here, and the delicacy, let's call
right.
it.
Right, yeah.
There's a real precision that Lorca has and a music.
Yeah, Lorca's wild, man. I mean, his range, like, stylistically is the entire spectrum. He's got those, you know, those long kind of ballads, but he also wrote, like, haiku and these very small lyric poems as well. Yeah, he's amazing, and it's just crazy to me to see him in James Wright's poems, like, when that comes up.
He's the man. Yeah. I mean, I think Lorca is one of the greats, partially because of the range, you know, and also because, in a weird way, you know, he was, of course, you know, executed and murdered right. by the Franco regime. And you realize that they read his poetry as political. All of those poems that could be read as apolitical
right.
in some way, they saw as deeply political, and also, you know, they were homophobic and
right.
all
yeah.
these questions. But I think that's really interesting in this political moment we're in now, where how do you write a political poem, and maybe you do it like Lorca does, you
yeah.
know? And another way to put it is, oh, we should be paying attention that nature can be political, that writing about these song, who you choose to write about, and I think that's one of the political parts of Lorca, is he's choosing to write about this small, vulnerable folk or a cricket, you know,
right, right.
that's really powerful and subversive.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think of that, too, when we turn to your poem, which I want to talk about in 1 second. But I wonder if how we make use and think about the political in this moment.
Yeah. People will say that, you know, the act alone of writing a poem in such a world, right, especially in a world in a country that only really values material, you know, like, what are you doing that's making money for somebody else? If you're writing poetry in a world that only values that, that's political, right? Or, you know, I think a lot of people would agree with that. I think I would agree with that as well. But, you know, tackling specific subject matters can be really, really difficult. And that's something that I'm currently struggling with. And I see other people struggling with it as well. Like, how do you address these things that are happening in a way that makes sense for the poem, as opposed to, like, if you have a big Twitter following, you could address these things and a lot of people would see it, maybe more than in a poem. So in, you know, in what mediums does it make sense to talk
sure.
about certain things?
That's a great, interesting question.
Yeah.
Let's leave that hanging, but I want to get back to it, because in the March 18th, 2019 issue of the magazine, The New Yorker published your poem, "Along the East River and in the Bronx, Young Men Were Singing," which you'll read for us shortly. Is there anything you want to tell us about it before you do?
The title is taken from Lorca's Ode to Walt Whitman. And it was actually kind of funny because a friend translated this poem into Spanish.
Translated your poem?
Yeah. And then he also translated the title into Spanish, which ended up being different than Lorca's original
line. Right, right, exactly.
So that was a little fun.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to hear it. Here is Ariel Francisco reading his poem, "Along the East River and in the Bronx, Young Men Were Singing."
Along the East River and in the Bronx, young men were singing. I heard them and I still hear them, above the threatening shrieks of police sirens, above the honking horns of morning traffic, above the home crowd cheers of Yankee Stadium, above the school bells and laughter lighting up the afternoon, above the clamoring trudge of the one train and the two and four, five, six, the B and the D, above the ice cream truck's warm jingle, above the stampede of children playing in the street, above the rush of a popped fire hydrant, above the racket of eviction notices, above the whisper of moss and mold moving in, above the High Bridge and the 145th Street Bridge, above mothers calling those children to come in for dinner, to come in before it gets dark, to get your ass inside, above them calling a child who may never come home, above the creaking plunge of nightfall and darkness settling in the deepest corners, above the Goodyear blimp circling the stadium, above the seagulls circling the coastal trash, along the East River and in the Bronx, young men are singing, and I hear them, eastbound into eternity, even as morning destars the sky.
That was Along the East River and in the Bronx, Young Men Were Singing by Ariel Francisco. So this Lorca title, I think, has served you well. It has this tremendous energy, I think. And I'm thinking of that era of Lorca in a way, a poet in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's a poet seeing more than any one person can see, but at the same time hearing so much that we overlook.
Yeah.
And I especially love the whisper of moss and mold moving in, which is ominous, but also the rush of a popped fire hydrant, the racket of eviction notices. There's this real clamor that is Whitman-esque on the one hand, and also I think very much your own. And tell me about that, how that came about for you, this list, this litany.
There's a small collection called Ode to Walt Whitman.
That's, yes, of course.
That's a small collection of Lorca's translations that my dad had got me for Christmas. I had read it before, but I was rereading it again maybe like 2 years ago. And that line really stood out to me because you don't often read about the Bronx in poems. You know, there's a lot about New York City and now more about Brooklyn. But it really caught
yeah,
my attention.
Yeah, there's no Brooklyn Bridge in this poem. I was like, all right, High Bridge. Yeah,
yeah,
different bridges.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the neighborhood where I'm from is High Bridge in the Bronx. So it was really cool that, you know, a poet like Lorca was writing about the Bronx. And something about that line stood out to me. And this kind of litany is not a mode that I ever write in. So I was trying, or was I trying? Or maybe this line gave me access to this kind of other kind of Lorcan mode, maybe, because I'm very much more of like this James Wright poem, like here I am, you know, the eye standing, observing, kind of thinking about things. And here I somehow totally removed, I mean, there's still the eye, but it's a more...
It's an ear as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Yeah, it's much more of an ear and not really there, like standing there. You know, typically I would be on the bridge looking out, thinking about things. That would be my mode. And here, somehow, this line of Lorca's gave me sort of, maybe permission is the right word, or kind of opened my eyes and ears to this other mode that I could get into.
Knowing it's a poem of home, it also feels like a poem, not of exile quite, but of elsewhere. It's like a poem that's able to, you know, if it was on a drone, dare I say, you would be zooming way
yeah,
up.
Yeah.
You know, you're zooming incredibly up and then also into people's houses and you can see the moss, you
yeah.
know. It's Whitman-esque in that way. But I also think the subject matter to me is special in that it's speaking to New York, it's thinking about New York, but it also is saying, like, I can list the trains. That's part of the poetry or the lyricism of
right.
the place.
Yeah, yeah. And knowing it that well, or, you know, having that specificity, I think is very important to, you know, so, you know, if you're writing about a place and, you know, I only said the one train, the two train.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about the Bronx, there's, you know, my cousins out there be like, hey, hold on.
Yeah, you messed up. Like,
yeah.
What about my train?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because I had a feeling when you said the two, I was like, the two, you know,
yeah,
goes
yeah.
right to the Schomburg Center.
Yeah, and that's what I love about going back to James Wright, that idea of place. Like, sometimes you do recognize the place, and that small detail is enough to completely pull you into the poem.
Well, it's a different kind of pastoral, I think, here. You know, for him, it feels like he's looking at, from the Rust Belt Midwest, looking at nature.
Yeah.
And here, maybe you're doing the same thing. I mean, you're looking at a sort of inside out, but it's part of the poem. You know, the Wright, it's his other poems that you know that he has this other life, you
right.
know, and this eye, which in the poetic tradition, it's very familiar to have someone say, oh, isn't that beautiful out there?
Yeah.
But they're writing from dirty London.
Yeah, yeah.
And here you're sort of saying, like, no, you're not on the bridge, as
right.
you said, but you're in a place,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
of the place. And then from there you go out And that ending is just tremendous. Eastbound into eternity even. I mean, three E's, that's not easy. And as morning de-stars the sky. And I think that verb is really tremendous because, of course, sometimes when the city, it feels de-starred already, but there is something there that you are noting, this change and this undoing, let's call it.
Yeah. And that's something I picked up. I can't remember the poem off the top. But D Stars is something I picked up from Paul Salon.
You don't have to tell all your secrets.
No, but he's great at, like,
yeah.
He puts words together like no one else, I think.
But this D starring isn't anyone else's now.
Right, yeah. No, he can't say anything about it.
I mean, it's yours now. You've made it happen. That's so powerful. I wonder about translation.
Yeah.
And how translation plays into your work as a whole, but also specifically here, because you mentioned this great effect of translating something back into its native language. Something I actually ended up doing when there was these Langston Hughes poems that were only in Uzbek, and I ended up translating them from, you know, a crib back into English, and then I found one of the poems later because they had been lost, and I was like, what? You know, and I was like, I got pretty close. You know, it's a strange thing to imitate someone you love. But you're coming from a different place. You translate from the Spanish, is that right?
Yeah, Spanish to English.
Yeah, and how's that changed your work? And is there some of that in this poem?
There might be a little bit of it in this poem. Coming from Lorca too, again, that kind of repetition. And it's a different kind of lyricism that it brings to me, I think, as opposed to like just English, like writing in relation to something in Spanish. Not even translating, but like having a Spanish poem or a Spanish poet in my head as I'm doing it gives a different kind of lyricism, which again is why I think this poem took the shape that it did, which, you know, is very much different.
So do you feel like the Spanish lyricism, as you put it, is that lurking behind this poem?
I think so. I hope so. I hope so. At least for me, because without that Lorca, even if I had this line, if maybe the line was someone else's, I think the poem would have come differently, because this kind of lineation, this kind of repetition is not of my English. I don't know if that makes sense. Even in like a very lyrical mode, I would never think to go there.
But in Spanish, it feels more natural.
It does, yeah. And again, even though, you know, I didn't write it in Spanish, but there was somehow Spanish in my brain as I was writing this. If that makes sense.
It does, actually. And do you write in Spanish?
Not too much. Just emails asking people for permission to translate their relatives or, you know, parents.
And, I mean, did you ever think of writing in Spanish?
Oh, yeah. I really want to.
It's a separate project for you.
It is, yeah. It would be very different. But I really want to try it. I can read in Spanish really, really well now. It's gotten a lot better because of translation. But, for example, I still have trouble translating from English to Spanish. So there are, like, some technical things. I spoke it well enough to get by in high school and college, you know, for an easy A. I never had to pay attention. So there are a lot of technical things that I'm missing if I were to try to write it. But I definitely, that's something that I really want to do.
Yeah. Well, I think you speak to how translation sometimes is a one-way street for us. You know, we try to run translations when we can, and I think it's a very important part of the tradition.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly, as we were talking about, it changed Wright's poetry and those deep image poets of the 60s. It changed their work.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's a recent effort you see where people are trying to think about translation, how much poorer we've been for abandoning it, as culturally speaking.
Yeah.
And, you know, what an interesting moment it is to talk about these different languages we all hear and maybe don't all have, but can learn from.
Yeah. I think it's vastly important. I mean, I've been the last few months I've been reading poetry almost only in Spanish. So not even in translation, but kind of finding books that don't exist in English. More part of it to look for more things to try and translate into English, but also just to have that in my brain more often and just kind of comprehend things in Spanish and see if that, I don't think it'll oppose the English in my brain. I keep talking about my brain as if there's more than one, right? But
yeah, you hopefully have several.
They mix together
yeah.
and create some kind of new brain. And I've been trying to learn German too.
Wow.
Which
those are the two languages I've been translated into is Spanish
really?
And German.
Oh, wow.
And the reason I knew that the German was working is I traveled in Germany with the translator, and he would read, we would trade off who would read which first. And he read this, one of my poems, and people laughed at the right places.
That's
I didn't, I don't speak German. But it was amazing to see that, you know.
That's great.
And this kind of, I don't want to say it's a lost art because it's still an art. I'm interested in that idea of translating not just from language to language, but from mode to mode.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's what happens in your poem. There is this, you know, before it gets dark to get your ass inside, these are different registers.
Yeah.
And I think I wouldn't like one without the other in the poem. The poem is invested in all of, you know, because it's so ecstatic and embracing.
Yeah.
I think it's invested in these different tones. It's after all said, you know, they were singing. They
right.
weren't simply speaking or talk, you know, this, you know, and song is one of those things that almost doesn't need translation. We
yeah.
dance to and listen to different musics all the time.
Yeah.
Tell me about what's next for you and what you're working on.
I'm working on a couple of translation projects. Well, I'm working on a lot of things. My second book is set to come out in April from Burrow Press.
What's it called?
It's called A Sinking Ship Is Still a Ship. So it's a big Florida book about growing up there, how much I hate it, in a hyperbolic kind of way, and also how it's sinking and no one seems to be doing anything about it.
So
it's a very watery
book. So you
book.
Were from the Bronx but grew up in Florida?
Yeah, I moved to Florida when I was small. I lived in Orlando until I was 11, and then I moved to Miami and lived there from 2001 until last year. Yeah. So you mentioned Exile earlier, and that's how I felt growing up in Florida.
So we have a Bronx poem, but you have Florida poems now.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of Florida poems. Not quite as celebrating.
Oh, wow.
But it's got a weird kind of love to it.
Yeah, sure.
I described it to someone recently as... you know, when a teenager yells out their stepfather, "You're not my real dad." That's how I feel about Florida, and I feel like that's the energy of that book. It's not totally sincere, but in that moment, it's very
sure,
much
yeah,
like,
it's passionate.
Yeah.
Well, I'm eager to read it. And then what are your translation projects you mentioned?
I'm translating this poet. I'm going to butcher his name maybe, but it's Jacques Vieux Renau, who was born in Haiti but grew up in the Dominican Republic. So he wrote in Spanish. And he was killed during the Civil War in 65. So he was just 23 years old. But he left behind, you know, about 100 plus pages of poems that are just like really, really incredible. He writes a lot about, he makes reference to his homeland a lot in those poems. And he never mentions really either country. He's kind of trying to reconcile, you know, the entirety of the island.
Yeah.
And the collection is called Poet of One Island. And it's just really fascinating. And
they're not translated yet.
No, there's a couple. I think I've only found like three online.
Yeah, that's
but
not, yeah.
I've got the whole thing in English. If any publishers are listening.
Yeah, I mean that sounds tremendous.
Yeah, it's. I have a few coming out.
And what is the what is the tone of it?
It's very, very sort of hopeful, but with you know this kind of impending. Sort of falling apart. So, you know, there's very much, again, he's writing of like trying to reconcile. But little by little, you see his support of like the revolutionaries grow stronger and stronger through the poems. And then after the poem ends, he actually joins the fight and is killed in the fight. And it's really, you know, there's a huge history of violence from the Dominican Republic against Haiti. And it becomes really interesting to have this kind of Haitian-born poet fighting for Dominican independence, you know, for a country who probably wouldn't have fought for him. Just his whole story, but the poems as well, it's all in there, and it's really, really fascinating. And well, I mean, geez, I look at his poems, and I look at the poems I was writing when I was 23, and it's like, it's wild.
Well, I can't wait to read and see more. And I love this description you have. I think you said hopeful, but there's this impending, I would almost call it doom. And I feel like that's sort of coursing through your poem in a way, but also through poetry right now. I see a lot of poems that are wrestling with our times, and I'm looking forward to seeing more from you about it.
Thank you.
Ariel, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Along the East River and in the Bronx, Young Men Were Singing by Ariel Francisco, as well as James Wright's By a Lake in Minnesota, can be found on NewYorker.com. Above the River, James Wright's complete poems, was published in 1992. Ariel Francisco's new book, A Sinking Ship is Still a Ship, is forthcoming in 2020. Thanks so much.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on newyorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff with help from Hannah Eisenman.